whatever you do.
This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. U.S. President Joe Biden is condemning Vladimir Putin's move to suspend Russia's participation in the last remaining nuclear arms control treaty with Washington, AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The so-called New START treaty was already on life support, given Russia canceling talks aimed at salvaging the pact. Putin has now pulled back. The president was in Poland, meeting with counterparts from NATO's eastern flank, pledging the U.S. will stay at their side as Putin's Ukraine invasion continues.
You're the front lines of our collective defense, and you know better than anyone what's at stake in this conflict.
Saying it's not just Ukraine, it's freedom itself. Sagar Magani, Washington.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Wednesday condemned Russia's invasion of Ukraine as the world body's General Assembly met in a special session 2 days before the anniversary of Moscow's attack.
That invasion is an affront to our collective conscience. It is a violation of the United Nations Charter and international law. It is having dramatic humanitarian and human rights consequences, and the impact is being felt far beyond Ukraine.
Guterres called the anniversary a grim milestone for the people of Ukraine and the international community. Mexican lawmakers on Wednesday approved a controversial overhaul of the body overseeing the country's elections, a move critics warn will weaken democracy ahead of a presidential vote next year. President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador argues the reorganization will save $150 million a year and reduce the influence of economic interests in politics. Follow us on the VOA mobile app. This is VOA News. Israeli troops have entered a major Palestinian city in the occupied West Bank in a rare daytime arrest operation, triggering fighting that killed at least 11 Palestinians and wounded scores of others. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The raid, which reduced a building to rubble and left a series of shops riddled with bullets, was one of the bloodiest battles in nearly a year of fighting in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Palestinian officials say a 72-year-old man is among the dead and over 100 people wounded. The brazen raid, coupled with the high death toll, raises the prospect of further bloodshed. A similar raid last month was followed by a deadly Palestinian attack outside a Jerusalem synagogue, and the Hamas militant group warning that its patience is running out. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Kenya's tourism ministry says earnings jumped 83% last year as the sector recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. Tourism revenue is expected to more than double over the next 4 years, as Victoria Amunga reports from Nairobi.
Earnings from the tourism sector increased to more than $2.1 billion last year. That's a gigantic leap. $1.6 billion earned in 2021 when the pandemic was holding down international travel. 16% of the visitors last year arrived from America, according to the ministry, about 12% from Uganda and 10% from the United Kingdom. The impact of COVID-19 in 2020 brought Kenya's tourism industry to a screeching halt, with more than 2 million people losing their jobs at the time. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerians will vote on Saturday in what could be their most credible and close electoral contest since military rule ended nearly a quarter of a century ago, amid fears that a close poll may be disputed and trigger even more violence and chaos. All candidates signed a peace pledge on Wednesday, promising to seek redress through the courts for any grievances.
Let me remind all Nigerians, not for the first time, that this is the only country we have, and we must do everything to keep it safe, united, and peaceful.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari at the signing in the capital Abuja adding, quote, there should be no riots or acts of violence after the assignment of the election results. A brutal winter storm in the U.S. has knocked out power in California, closed interstate highways from the western state of Arizona to Wyoming, and prompted more than 1,200 flight cancellations. Schools throughout the northern states, including the Dakotas, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, were called off. Find more on our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Thursday, February 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Adofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, President Joe Biden heads back to Washington after a four-day visit to Poland and Ukraine.
President Biden is reaffirming U.S. commitment for benign security. These are, of course, all the members who were previously under Moscow's sphere of influence during the Cold War.
Israeli forces kill at least 10 Palestinians in West Bank as tensions rise.
Israeli troops besieged the building in the flashpoint city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. It's ruined testimony to the deadly clash that followed.
And the Philippines discussed security patrols in the South China Sea with the US and Australia. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. President Joe Biden is heading back to Washington after a four-day visit to Poland and Ukraine. He reassured Eastern flank NATO allies that his administration is keenly attuned to the looming threats and other impacts of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. VOA's Laurie London spoke to VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara in Warsaw, traveling with the president.
Patsy, the president, along with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, attended a summit today with the so-called Bucharest Nine countries on the alliance's, the most eastern flank countries. Can you tell us a little bit about how that went? And I know that there were a lot of anxieties about Putin potentially making a move to take military action against them if he's successful in Ukraine.
Well, certainly this is a grouping that is most anxious about what is happening in Ukraine right now. This is a grouping that, you know, not many people outside of Europe know. It's an initiative launched in 2015 by Romanian President Klaus Iohannis and Polish President Andrzej Duda, essentially to enhance cooperation amongst NATO's newest members in support of the alliance's goals to improve security and stability in that eastern flank region between the Baltic and the Black Seas. So they just met, and President Biden is reaffirming U.S. commitment for benign security. These are, of course, all the members who were previously under Moscow's sphere of influence during the Cold War, but are now looking at Moscow's expansionist ambitions with concern. And so President Biden said today that Washington's sacred commitment to defend NATO's Article 5 of collective defense is sacred. He's saying that this is the few nations are the front lines of our collective defense, and you know better than anyone else what is at stake in this conflict. And that's a message that's also repeated by Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, who said that 1 year since the invasion, Russian President Vladimir Putin is showing no signs of stopping. He is not preparing for peace. He's preparing for more war. So we must step up our support for Ukraine. There's a general anxiety among benign members, even though there's a different level of support for Ukraine among the members. One notable absent leader is Hungary's Viktor Orban, the prime minister, who sent his president instead, more a ceremonial position there. Because as we know, Hungary is landlocked and is very much dependent on Moscow for oil and gas. So Orban has made a couple of declarations in support of Moscow, saying that the war in Ukraine is not a conflict between the armies of good and evil, but between two Slavic countries that are fighting against each other, and that is their war, not ours. So there's some differences of opinions and levels of support, but broadly speaking, there's going to be unity coming out, expected coming out of this summit in preparation for the NATO summit in Vilnius in July.
And of course, yesterday, President Biden came out really strong in a speech from Warsaw. Can you tell us a bit briefly about how that was received on the ground, and as well as also how White House officials are feeling about the whole trip?
We had a chat with several members of the National Security Council team last night, and it seems like they are feeling good about what happened in the past 2 days. They were able to pull off the Kyiv trip, which was, of course, under secrecy. It was a surprise visit. But generally, they felt like it was the right thing to do. They were happy that they were able to pull it off. And they also pushed back against Russian claims, particularly the one made by former President Medvedev, who said that, you know, Biden is going to Kyiv because Russia has given security guarantees. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told me that that's not the case. Now, as for the speech itself, it was really a sight to be seen. There were hundreds of people lined up. And then when we got there, it was fully packed. It was outdoors. Thousands of crowds. I mean, by the Warsaw mayor's office, it was 30,000 people.
That's VOA White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara in Warsaw. President Vladimir Putin said on Wednesday that China's Xi Jinping will visit Russia, saying relations had reached, quote, new frontiers, unquote, amid U.S. concerns that Beijing could provide material support to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters reports.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin has confirmed that China's President Xi Jinping will visit him in Russia in the near future, and that the country's relationship is reaching, quote, new frontiers, with an obvious nod to competition with the West, which fears Beijing could start providing Russia with weapons for the Ukraine war. This was Putin meeting China's highest-ranking diplomat, Wang Yi, at the Kremlin on Wednesday. Wang is saying here that crises can become opportunities and that ties between China and Russia won't be coerced or pressured by third parties. Wang also said he was looking forward to striking new agreements with Russia during his trip without giving specifics. Historically, China has distanced itself rhetorically from the war and hasn't given material aid to Russia, which could expose it to U.S. sanctions.
That's Matthew LaRotonda of Reuters. A new report by the group Action Against Hunger says the world is facing a 53% shortfall in funds for hunger programs, and countries are going through the worst crisis, including many in Africa, that receive less funding than countries with lower rates of hunger. Eric Babadis is the director of external relations for Action Against Hunger. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that unfortunately, countries like Somalia were already on a trajectory that was not favorable before Russia invaded Ukraine 1 year ago.
Right now, about 828 million people around the world go to bed hungry each night. And the conflict in Ukraine only worsened this. It took vulnerabilities that existed at the local, regional, and global level that were already there because of conflict, climate change, chronic inequality, the COVID-19 pandemic, and threw accelerant on it. I think most of your listeners are going to know that prior to the war, Russia and Ukraine exported nearly a third of the world's barley and wheat, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and a large percentage of corn or maize. And the war made it even more difficult for this to get to market, and it increased the price at the local and regional level.
Talk about how that changed for the people who live in Africa, their lives on a day-to-day basis, and what countries specifically are we talking about mostly?
Yeah, so it's a number. We've focused in on the Horn and beyond, but I'd say before the war, almost all, 90% plus of Somalia's wheat imports were coming from Ukraine and Russia. And so now with inflation, rising food costs, and the conflict, plus the record drought that's happening in Somalia, we're looking at a terrible situation where it's becoming even more expensive to get vital food aid. But it's not just limited to Somalia. We've seen an inflationary environment impacting food prices in Malawi and Zambia. In Malawi, food prices have gone up 142% since 2020, only aggravated by the conflict. And in Zambia, it's 120%.
When you talk about 120-some percent and 140-some percent inflation for food prices, how do people even survive? How do they put food on their table?
They're making really difficult decisions on a family and individual basis. So it's requiring families to really cut aggressively the number of calories they intake, how much food sits on their table. They still have money. There's still money flowing through the economy, but it's just not going as far as it used to. So what might have bought a full plate of food in the past now doesn't. And people are resorting to just smaller portions and fewer options. Which is, of course, driving what we look at Action Against Hunger, which is increasing rise in the number of people who go to bed hungry each night.
Let me throw a quote at you. By raising prices for food and fertilizer, the war in Ukraine is killing Somali children. That's what Ahmed Khalif, your country director for Action Against Hunger in Somalia, said. He said that countries with lower hunger rates received more funding than countries going through the worst hunger crisis. Does he mean by that that people in Africa are suffering more as a direct result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and that they should be getting more money than they are now, even with this war in Ukraine?
So one of the things that we found with our GAAP report released today was that paradoxically, the countries experiencing the most acute forms of malnutrition were receiving, relatively speaking, fewer dollars than those experiencing in a less severe situation. So Ahmed's quote is spot on when we talk about Somalia, because the need there is greater. As I mentioned before, we're experiencing historic levels of drought, and the price of food has increased. So it makes it an already challenging situation nearly impossible.
That's Eric Babanitz, Director of External Relations for Action Against Hunger. He was speaking from New York with my colleague Carol Van Dam. Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians, including at least 3 gunmen and 3 civilians, and wounded over 100 others in a raid on a flashpoint city in the occupied West Bank on Wednesday, according to witnesses and medical officials. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
Israeli troops besieged the building in the flashpoint city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank, its ruin testimony to the deadly clash that followed. Among the Palestinian dead, at least 3 gunmen and 3 civilians, including a 72-year-old man and a 14-year-old boy. In total, at least 10 were killed. More than 100 other Palestinians were wounded, according to witnesses and medics. Israel's military said there were no Israeli casualties. The Israelis encircled 2 Islamic Jihad commanders in the house, the Palestinian militant faction confirmed. That triggered fighting that drew in other gunmen. The 2 commanders were killed. The Israeli military said troops shot back after coming under fire. They were trying to detain militants suspected of planning imminent attacks. Israel has intensified raids in the West Bank, especially Nablus and nearby Jenin, over the last year, following a spate of lethal street attacks by Palestinians in Israeli cities. 60 Palestinians, both gunmen and civilians, have been killed in 2023, the Palestinian Health Ministry says. Israel says 10 Israelis and a Ukrainian tourist died in Palestinian attacks in that period. Hamas said one of its own gunmen was also killed in Wednesday's raid. It hinted at possible reprisals from the Gaza Strip, a territory that it controls.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters, and the UN peacekeeping mission in Mali says a roadside bomb has killed 3 peacekeepers and seriously injured 5 others. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
MINUSMA said in a statement that the UN peacekeepers were killed in central Mali Tuesday when their vehicle hit an improvised explosive device. The statement says that MINUSMA is one of the most dangerous peace operations for peacekeepers, with 168 peacekeepers killed in hostile acts since the establishment of the mission in 2013. Mali and the Greater Sahel region have been battling an Islamist insurgency since 2012, when Islamists took over the north of the country. The French army intervened in 2013 to help Mali take back control of the north, but withdrew from the country last year due to concerns about Mali's military government working with Russian Wagner Group mercenaries. Mali has been under military rule since an August 2020 coup. The government denies working with Russian mercenaries, but human rights groups and journalists have documented several alleged human rights abuses committed by them since reports of their arrival in the country. The military government expelled MINUSMA's spokesperson last year after Ivorian soldiers arriving as support for a UN contingent in Mali were arrested at Bamako's airport. The director of the mission's human rights division was expelled this month. Violence has continued to plague the Sahel in recent years. 51 Burkinabe soldiers were killed last week in Burkina Faso's north in a suspected Islamist attack. A police officer and a civilian were killed on Monday in an IED attack in western Mali. No group has claimed responsibility for Tuesday's attack on the UN peacekeepers. Annie Risenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
In other news, the Philippines is discussing joint security patrols in the South China Sea with the United States, as well as Australia, as China increasing aggressive action in the disputed waters caused concern. Philippine Defense Chief Carlito Galvez Jr. discussed the possibility of joint patrols in a telephone call with U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and in a separate meeting with his Australian counterpart Richard Marles, who is visiting Manila. China opposes military activities involving the U.S. and its allies and has protested the presence of U.S. naval ships and fighters that have been enforcing freedom of movement in the contested waters. The Philippines protested when the Chinese Coast Guard used a military-guided laser against a Philippine patrol vessel earlier this month. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Junaid Rofo in Washington. Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, goes to the polls Saturday to elect a new president amid worsening insecurity and economic struggles. Tensions over a shortage of cash and fuel could also influence how people vote. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
Nigeria's most contested presidential election in 24 years is near. And with a record 93.4 million Nigerians registered to vote, including more than 10 million new voters, mostly young people, observers say the dynamics of this race may be different than any election before.
He's 55 years old.
They predict Peter Obi will benefit most from the new voters. Experts say he's a formidable third-party force in a country where presidential elections have traditionally been a contest between the two main parties. Abuja resident Jason Onwe says Obi is the best man for the job.
This man has what I call a clean slate. He said, if you have any accusation, bring it up, let me see. And till today, 9 months ago, he said that. Till today, nobody has brought any accusation. So yeah, that's why I am voting for Peter Obi.
Obi promises economic reforms and prudent government spending, but he's competing against the established giants of Nigeria's politics. Bola Ahmed Tinubu of the ruling APC party, known as a political kingmaker, promises he will fight insecurity and continue the policies of outgoing President Muhammadu Buhari. There's also the major opposition People's Democratic Party candidate, Atiku Abubakar, who's a former vice president. His supporters say his experience makes him the best choice. Nigeria has been struggling to control widespread insecurity and prevent its economy from nosediving. But experts say those are not the only factors influencing votes this time. Idayat Hassan is a director at the Center for Democracy and Development.
The combination of the fuel scarcity for an oil-producing nation like Nigeria and the scarcity of Naira is now redefined the whole electoral system, is redefined even how people were likely to vote and what we expect to see on election day in a closely contested election where little things will actually matter.
Nigeria's central bank is implementing a currency reform that has led to scarcity of hard cash. Many of the candidates have called for the CBN to extend its deadline on the currency transition, but the central bank, backed by the president, has refused. Aliyu Abdullahi is an Abuja resident who says he has struggled to deal with the cash policy.
Just about 3 days ago, chaos about this cash issue led to violence in my area, and two people were killed. This bruise on my nose was from that day.
In the run-up to the vote, however, election workers have come under attack in several areas. As millions head to the polls, there is concern about possible violence. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Thank you, Timothy. And Kenya's tourism ministry says earnings jumped 83% last year as the sector recovered from the COVID-19 pandemic. Tourism revenue is expected to more than double over the next 4 years, as Victoria Muga reports from Nairobi.
A new report from Kenya's Ministry of Tourism says earnings from the tourism sector increased to more than $2.1 billion last year. That's a gigantic leap from the $1.16 billion earned in 2021 when the pandemic was holding down international travel. The number of international tourists also grew to over 1.4 million compared to 870,000 in 2021. 16% of the visitors last year arrived from America, according to the ministry, about 12% from Uganda and 10% from the United Kingdom. Penina Malonza is Kenya's Minister of Tourism, Wildlife and Heritage.
Because of the nature of the relationship that we have with US, of course, and of course the nature of the numbers. If you do a proper marketing in any country, and if that country has good numbers, of course, looking at the population of U.S. is quite large population, and this is our traditional markets.
The impact of COVID-19 in 2020 brought Kenya's tourism industry to a screeching halt, with more than 2 million people losing their jobs at the time. Most have since returned to work. The tourism sector accounts for 10.4% of Kenya's economy and 5.5% of formal employment. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Hi, I'm Rick Bantaleo. Be sure to join me for the next Science Edition of Press Conference USA, when we'll learn about nanotechnology. It's the developing field of science and technology that controls and works with materials at measures below microscopic levels. Nanotechnology is already being applied in areas such as information technology, medicine, energy, and environmental science. Listen this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Around the clock, The Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-Minute VOA Newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Junior Dwarf in Washington. Wishing you a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The state of the NATO alliance today is remarkably strong, possibly the strongest it's ever been, declared U.S. Ambassador to NATO Julianne Smith in a recent interview.
We have a moment in alliance history where the alliance is being challenged by a war not so far from NATO territory, but the ways in which the allies have come together over the last year has been nothing short of remarkable.
Allies have activated their defense in multiple ways, said Ambassador Smith.
The allies have come together, first and foremost, to reinforce NATO's eastern flank, to make sure that its members in Eastern Europe have what they need to feel secure and safe in this moment. Secondly, individual allies have come together to support the Ukrainian people and support the Ukrainian military forces. And third, the transatlantic allies are united in their efforts to apply maximum pressure on Moscow to make sure that they understand the consequences of this brutal war that's still ongoing inside Ukraine.
NATO's support for Ukraine is robust, and it's just as strong as it was on the day that Russia started this war, said Ambassador Smith.
I think some folks out there, particularly President Putin, expected Western support for Ukraine or NATO support for Ukraine to somehow trail off, but that's absolutely not the case. Allies have come together just in recent days to restate and reaffirm their strong support for Ukraine. Allies fundamentally understand what's at stake. They understand that the Ukrainian military forces are not only fighting to defend their own territory, but Ukrainian military forces are fighting to protect the values that NATO allies hold dear and that they want to protect as well.
I see no sign of alliance unity coming undone, declared Ambassador Smith. I see no NATO allies running for the exit. Quite the contrary. What I see are allies that are in it for as long as it takes and will continue to support both the people of Ukraine and those military forces inside Ukraine that are defending Ukraine's territorial sovereignty.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.